This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, April 14th, 2014. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, an audio poetry goldmine. Probably the most famous and prestigious poetry reading series in the country is put on by the Unterberg Poetry Center at the 92nd Street Y in New York City. It started way back in 1939, and everyone from W.H. Auden and Wallace Stevens to Adrian Rich and Jory Graham has read for it. The amazing thing about it, they have recordings, a veritable goldmine of audio poetry. And in recent years, they've been making these recordings available online. To celebrate their 75th anniversary, the Unterberg Poetry Center has been inviting authors to listen and write about their favorite recordings from the archives, so we can read what Forrest Gander has to say about Marianne Moore's performance, or Sarah Lindsay on Amy Clampett, to name just two of them. I'm joined by the director of the Unterberg Poetry Center, Bernard Schwartz, and I've asked him to pick out two of his favorite recordings from their incredible archive. Bernard, you've got a lot to choose from. Give us a sense, before we get to your recordings that you chose, give us a sense of the breadth and depth of the archive you have there.
Sure. The archive of recordings began in 1949 with a reading by E.E. Cummings.
Let me interrupt. So it's 10 years after the center began. Then the 92nd Street Y started making the recordings.
Yes, I know a lot about the history of the Y and the Poetry Center. I cannot account for when that decision was made and who first pressed play. So we have E.E. Cummings, we have Auden, as you said, we have Marianne Moore, we have Elizabeth Bishop, we have Lowell, we have T.S. Eliot, we have Robert Frost.
You chose one of the most famous readers of poetry ever, Dylan Thomas. He read at the 92nd Street Y on May 14th, 1953. That's the same year he died. Now, before we listen to a bit of that recording of Under Milkwood, his famous radio play, can you tell us something about the recording? Apparently, there's a lot of goings-on about this particular performance and recording.
Sure. This was 1953. Dylan Thomas comes with Under Milkwood, a play for voices that he had been writing for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And in correspondence between Thomas and John Malcolm Brennan, who was director of the Poetry Center at the time, they have established the premier staged reading to be May 14th, 1953, and the implicit hope is that Thomas will be done writing it by then.
And sober.
Yes. However, he is not done writing it by May 14th, 1953, and he's not even done writing it 20 minutes before the curtain is supposed to go up. Brennan and his associates at the Poetry Center had typists at the ready. So there was an assembly line where Dylan was scribbling. Brennan's associate, Liz Reitel, was making legible those scribblings which were not. They were then handed off to typists, and the typists were then creating scripts. The first stage reading, which we're about to hear an excerpt from, of Under Milkwood, starred Dylan Thomas. You'll be hearing the opening of Under Milkwood,
right,
which Dylan Thomas reads. The cast was Dylan Thomas and five other actors. And they did it with very little preparation because they only got the finished script minutes before the curtain went up.
Well, that sounds like a very exciting night at the 92nd Street Y. Let's hear a little bit of it. Under Milkwood, as you said, is actually a radio drama. It was later adapted as a stage play. And it's about the dreams and thoughts of the inhabitants of a fictional Welsh fishing village, whose name I can't pronounce. So let's hear the first minute or so from when the narrator, Dylan Thomas, introduces the town and its sleeping inhabitants.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town. Starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent, and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat, there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds. And all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush, the babies are sleeping, the farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobblers, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the webfoot cockle women and the tidy wives. Young girls lie bedded soft or glide in their dreams with rings and trousseaus, bridesmaided by glowworms down the aisles of the organ-playing wood. The boys are dreaming wicked or of the bucking ranches of the night and the jolly Roger C. And the anthracite statues of the horses sleep in the fields, and the cows in the byres, and the dogs in the wet-nosed yards. And the cats nap in the slant corners, all lope, sly, streaking and needling on the one cloud of the roof.
I love how he includes even dogs and cats in his catalog of the town's inhabitants there. Now, I don't sense any of the nervousness that one would anticipate with a performance that was just basically written moments before.
Well, he was a consummate performer. In fact, on other recordings that we have of him, which have not yet been released, it's interesting to hear the transitions he makes between readings when he is just introducing a poem or talking to the audience. It's a very different Dylan Thomas.
He's a real performer. He really performs his poems.
He does. And of course, a piece like Under Milkwood is perfectly suited for that talent that he had.
Dylan Thomas and his oratorical style of reading have had an enormous effect on poets, especially in his own day. American poets in particular really had to up their game if they were going to compete. Do you sense in your history of in your review of all the recordings, do you sense a Dylan Thomas effect over the years?
It's a really good question. I don't think anybody comes close.
Yeah, nobody really does.
I mean, he was an actor of his own work, let's say.
Yeah.
He was a huge hit.
Let's turn to the second poem you chose. This is a much more recent recording. It's of the late Seamus Heaney, reading in 2011. Bernard, why'd you pick this particular recording?
Well, there are some connections to be made between Dylan Thomas and Seamus Heaney.
Mm-hmm.
Seamus Heaney said that the records of Dylan Thomas reading his own poems lined the shelves of undergraduate flats all over the world and were important cultural events. I'm touched by the idea that the same recording we just heard of Dylan Thomas reading Under Milkwood, or the other famous recordings that exist of him reading his own work and others' works, would have been owned by Seamus Heaney as a teenager and would have had some formative effect. I don't think it's surprising that young poets are still crushing on Dylan Thomas.
Yeah. Well, he was a star, and such that the poetry world had never really seen someone like that. So the poem we're going to listen to is called A Kite for a Veen, and the poem itself is an adaptation of a poem by the Italian Giovanni Pascoli. It's about a kite, simple as that.
This is the last poem in the book, and the most recent book. This is for a grandchild. There was a lot of sorrow and elegy in the book, but our grandchild arrived, second grandchild in this case. I have poems for the first grandchild earlier on, but there's a big long one, so we can't. It's kind of a sequence of 12 poems. You don't want that. So this is for number two, and her name is Aveen. So this is A Kite for Aveen, after Pascoli. Air from another life and time and place, pale blue heavenly air is supporting a white wing beating high against the breeze. And yes, it is a kite. As when one afternoon, all of us there trooped out among the briar hedges and stripped thorn, I take my stand again, halt opposite Anahorish Hill to scan the blue, back in that field to launch our long-tailed comet. And now it hovers, tugs, dives, veers askew, lifts itself, goes with the wind, until it rises to loud cheers from us below. Rises, and my hand is like a spindle unspooling, the kite a thin-stemmed flower climbing and carrying, carrying farther, higher, the longing in the breast and planted feet and gazing face and heart of the kite flyer, until string breaks, and separate, elate, the kite takes off, itself alone, a windfall. Thank you very much.
So Bernard Heaney was already old when he wrote this poem. It was the last poem in the last book he ever published. So it's touching to think of it as a kind of farewell poem to his grandchild. Maybe this is reading too much into it, but the string that's going to break is perhaps his own tether to life in a way. Is that reading too much into that poem? It has that pathos about it to me.
It certainly has that pathos, especially given it's echoing a line from the earlier kite poem he wrote for his sons, where he says, before the kite plunges down into the wood and this line goes useless, take in your two hands, boys, and feel the strumming, rooted, long-tailed pull of grief.
Yeah, it seems clear that it's not just a kite he's talking about here.
And now it hovers, tugs, dives, veers askew, lifts itself, goes with the wind, until it rises to loud cheers from us below.
Yeah, that's a kite, but it's also metaphorically something else. And then the part that really kind of moves me is
the longing in the breast and planted feet and gazing face and heart of the kite flyer until string breaks.
That seems to me the sort of heartbreaking moment in the poem itself.
I think you're right, because the point of flying a kite is to keep hold of the string.
And to watch the beautiful kite up there.
That's right. There is letting go, but then there is separation that comes from breaking. And when the kite flies away, you would not think it was because we have let it go. And when it flies away, we can still see it. But our connection to it is no longer physical.
And separate, elate, the kite takes off, itself alone, a windfall.
And the windfall normally would mean a windfall of money or literally a windfall of a falling of the wind. It's a beautiful image. It's an image to celebrate.
And at the same time, the kite in this poem, as opposed to the kite poem he wrote for his sons, is much more of a kite.
Yeah.
In the earlier poem. But you cannot read this poem for his granddaughter without sensing the earlier poem.
Now, I noticed that the two poets you chose for the program today both hail from the British Isles. And by that choice, are you implying that maybe over there they are better readers of poetry than their American counterparts? I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you, but I'm just curious. You were attracted to the accents?
I'm attracted to the music.
Yeah. Bernard Schwartz, thanks very much.
Thank you, Curtis.
Bernard Schwartz is the director of the Unterberg Poetry Center at the 92nd Street Y in New York City. Check out their online project, 75 at 75, Writers on Recordings. It's on their website, 92y.org. There's lots of great recordings and probably at least one by your favorite poets. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.